Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, April 21st, 1927, a district-level Army engineer sent a wire message to the head of the Army Corps of Engineers that read this, quote, "Levee broke at Mounds, Mississippi, 8 a.m. Crevice will overflow the entire Mississippi Delta." Of course, this note about the levee breach at Mounds, Mississippi meant that it was already too late. Mounds was one of the worst breaches, but there would be breaches all along the Mississippi leading to the enormous and disastrous flood, the Great Flood of 1927. In some places, hundreds of homes would be wiped out in a matter of seconds, of minutes. Other places, the water would come a little more slowly. If we remember anything about the 1927 flood, it may be those images along the Delta, the stories of the levees breaking or being broken in New Orleans, which we will discuss. But for a sense of scale, some 10 million acres of land over seven states would eventually be under 10 feet of water, almost 750,000 people displaced. This is an enormous, enormous event that, as we will discuss, basically reshapes the history of the Mississippi Delta and the region at a very critical moment in history. So here to discuss, as always, are Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley. Hello there.
Hello, Jody.
Hey there.
And our special guest for this episode back on the show is Wright Thompson, writer for ESPN and The Atlantic. And when I asked him how we should intro him, he said, "Stressed out father of two who lives in Mississippi." But Wright, thanks for making a little bit of time to join us.
It's my pleasure, man. If this could last like 6 hours through that would be fabulous.
Exactly. Yeah, this is all our escape. So look, a lot of details here. And, you know, as I mentioned, I think, right, I'm very curious your thoughts on kind of how this did reshape the region in a way that it still lingers to today. But, you know, in reading back on this story, one thing that I think is really fascinating is the river, the Mississippi, from, you know, top to tail, started to rise over the course of a year and a half. People saw that it was rising. And so it's just one of these stories of it happens slowly until it happens fast. And I'm just curious if you have a sense or can put that in context of what it's like to watch this river slowly, slowly rise and know sort of where this is all headed.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I actually still live a little bit in concert with the river. I mean, my family spends a lot of time over across the levee. And, you know, so I love to sit up on those bluffs with the river and you can watch it. You can watch it rise. And I mean, it's really crazy. It doesn't take much rain for it to start coming up and coming up. And so when you read accounts from the 20s, you have this sense of like overnight dread that just lingers. I mean, and, you know, it rose all year, but what people don't realize is there'd been several sort of breaches leading up to this. Mm-hmm. So the idea that this was coming and was sort of out there in the dark was very much present in people's lives. And yet, like you said, when it happened, it came fast. I mean, one of the things I've always thought that was so interesting about this is that if you want to look at this, you want to go much further back than 1927 because, you know, there were huge Native American settlements all around here. And it's what archaeologists call the Green Line. And it follows Highway 82 roughly from, say, Greenwood to Greenville is why they call it the Green Line in Mississippi. And there's sort of a DMZ about 20 miles on either side of the Green Line. And the Native American settlements to the north of that were all influenced from the north by like the Cahokian culture coming down from like St. Louis. And below the Green Line, they were influenced by like the Plaquemine culture coming up from Louisiana. But there was no one settled in that huge swath of land around the Green Line. And what you notice is that dead center in that DMZ where no one settled is Scott, Mississippi, which is where the levee broke in 1927. Yeah. And so these very ancient cultures seem to understand that there was something about that spot that should be avoided. That I've never been able to shake that when I tell people about the 1927 flood. Like, the power and mystery of the river has been something people have been scared of for thousands of years, long before anyone even recorded any of those fears or wrote them down.
You know, it's interesting to put that natural history next to the history of human intervention around the Mississippi, mm-hmm. which seems to have made the 1927 flood much worse. And those are things like the narrowing of the river, trying to contain it, which actually led it to be particularly constrained, and for the floodwaters to rise, or the river levels to rise much higher, and also sealing off tributaries in order to, again, like, prevent flooding in the short term, but leaving the river sort of nowhere to go but mm-hmm. to break through these various levees. And it's that sense that you were talking about, like, the river is going to go where the river is going to go, but there are all of these efforts to try to contain it that just make the situation worse.
Oh, and when you look at especially New Orleans, what's so interesting is that just before the Civil War, there was a big fight in the engineering community about how to handle the river. And there were sort of two really smart people within the Army Corps of Engineers. And one of them said, you know, you need to build walls and hem it in. And the other said, you need to leave gaps in the levee to release the pressure. And so the war started and this debate was put on hold. And then the engineer who wanted to shunt off the river was actually killed by Confederates in the Battle of Memphis. And so the South actually accidentally killed the person whose plan for the water would have protected all of the South in 1927. Wow.
You know, I always talk about the flood as it relates to the Great Migration, because when I'm teaching about it, we talk about, like, the push-pull factors, the industries that sort of pull people to the north. But a lot of the push factors, I should say, were, one, racial violence, but also this flood was so massive. I mean, I don't think we realize 27,000 square miles. That's Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Hampshire, and Vermont combined. You know, you're talking about, you know, some places the size of Delaware that are just underwater or uninhabitable. And that kind of massive destruction, people can't stay. You know, that water doesn't recede right away. It really takes until the end of the summer for that water to finally go back down again. And so many Black people are also harmed by this. So many Black people are even held at gunpoint to keep them there, to keep them on the levees. These tent cities are set up. But the societal and cultural impact that this has, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's sort of the Katrina of the 20th century, when you think about the devastation that pans out over generations.
And to your point, I mean, to me, the defining takeaway, when you read the oral histories or you read the books about this, there was never enough labor to farm all this land to begin with. Mm. And so in the first days of the flood, the people who own these huge planting operations, and at this point it was still mostly London, New York, Manchester, Liverpool money who owned these. I mean, like, the money, Mississippi, a very famous town for terrible reasons. I mean, the money planting company was owned by Charles Merrill of Merrill Lynch. Mm-hmm. And the plantation closest to where the levee broke was the Delta Pine and Land and Pine. It was owned by the Manchester Fine Doublers and Spinners Association, which was the largest manufacturing conglomerate in England. That company still exists, by the way. If you've ever bought anything from Marks and Spencer or Victoria's Secret, then you were buying from the people who own the largest cotton plantation in the world. But the degrees to which, I mean, I think they called in the National Guard to basically hold workers at gunpoint, as if there was anywhere to go, by the way, in these they call them tent cities. Let's call them what they were, which is tent prisons. Mm-hmm. And so you had people who had lost everything, and they were trying to keep the labor force from leaving. Because to your point, I mean, the Great Migration had started by then, and the idea that this was going to be the last straw was a deep fear for a lot of these, you know, landowners who just held their workforce sitting on tops of levees at gunpoint. And I mean, you just can't, the stories are unbelievable about the violence and forcing people to not get to safety.
Well, this particular date that we're marking here, the April 21st, when the levee breaks at Mound Landing, there were a few hundred prisoners who were killed at that exact moment on this exact night, who were forced to stay there to try and hold back the water and were unable to, and their bodies drifted, you know, for several miles down from the settlement.
You know, and the river's always moving. I mean, when my mom was a little girl, there was a town called Prentice, Mississippi, that had been washed away. And, you know, the river is always turning. And, you know, she talks about when she was little, the town that had been buried by the river and was underwater and covered in silt, all of that fell back away into the river. And for a little while, half of the old Prentice courthouse was just sticking out of a cliff into the river, you know. And like, so this was all very, very, you know, I mean, the river has always taken things away and it is always moving.
This reminds me of the song that Fela Kuti has, Water Get No Enemy, which means, you know, the idea that you need water to survive. You need water to live. And yet, you know, you can't really be at odds with it because of that necessity. But at the same time, you cannot curb it. You cannot stop it. You cannot wield it. I mean, water is its own force.
Flooding is its own, is, you know, flooding is what leads to this area being so economically significant. I want to go back to this notion of opportunity and push and pull. And we've talked a lot about, you know, the flood itself pushing a lot of people out of this region. But, you know, it's also worth highlighting that in the 20s, the Mississippi Delta was seen as a place of opportunity. And the Mississippi River Commission talked about how the levees were a, quote, chance for the Negro to better his condition. Nowhere else in the South are conditions as favorable and opportunities offered to the black man as in the reclaimed Mississippi lowlands. So I think that adds another element of tragedy here, that this was initially seen as a place of opportunity and economic uplift.
It's such an interesting way to present that area, because if you live in river areas, I grew up near the Ohio River, there's a lot of judgment about people who live in floodplains because they're using this very fertile land, but there's a lot of risk associated with it. And yet in this case, the government is saying, well, we've taken away that risk, right? Here you can have that fertile land, but we created these levees, so it's going to be okay. But of course, what happens? The flood still comes anyway.
And you know, it's interesting, too, that the Mississippi Delta, you know, one of the reasons that it was being pushed is that in a lot of ways, it was the last wild place in America. I mean, you know, along the edges of it, it had been settled for a long time. But the heart of the Mississippi Delta was basically uninhabited until, you know, 1885. And so, you know, like there were no people living in Sunflower County when we captured Geronimo, you know, and so. This was one of the last uninhabited wild places. It was all hardwood, lowland swamps. And when the great lumber machine sort of cut the Great North down, all of these lumber companies came to Memphis. I mean, before Memphis was a cotton capital, it was the hardwood capital of the world. It's because there were these huge timber companies who were coming down into the Mississippi Delta and clearing all of this. And it turned into cotton because they sort of needed something to do with the land after they had cleared the hardwood forest.
Well, I think what you're seeing is a transformation that's kind of already underway in this region. So like the Great Migration had started a little bit before this, and the transformation of the Southern economy is starting. But the flood operates as a catalyst for shoving the region into its next phase.
Yeah, I think about the flood of 1927. I also think about the boll weevil that decimated cotton crops. I think there are a lot of things that are pushing people out of the South economically, socially, politically, that make this a tragedy when you think about the potential that this space and place has to bring people prosperity. But I mean, that flood just it does so much. It's in a short amount of time, it reverberates for decades.
And you know, we could also talk about the birth of conspiracy theory, because they did blow the levees in New Orleans
in 27
Yes. And so
tamping down.
I know where you're headed, but just to be clear, the actual statement is in 27, they did blow the levees in New Orleans. And then.
And so, you know, but they did it to protect the best parts of New Orleans. And there were a lot of, you know, white, brown, and black sharecroppers who lived down there just got crushed. Mm. You know, what's that? That beautiful, beautiful Randy Newman song that Aaron Neville does so well. Louisiana, Louisiana, they're trying to wash us away. Mm. I mean, like, you know, there's entire sort of still vibrant sense of anger and populism in pockets of Louisiana that have been handed down like family heirlooms about this is what the people in power will do to you. So they will literally blow the levees.
Mm. And of course, in 2005, when we see the exact same types of communities hit so hard after Katrina, it's no surprise that these same kinds of theories and conversations and concerns come back up.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting if you look at the way that the flood was viewed at the time, particularly from outside of the South. There was a lot of judgment about the South, which was viewed by many Northerners as this very backwards place. It was something that had come up just a few years earlier when the Scopes trial happened in Tennessee, that the South was this redoubt of, you know, people who didn't believe in science and Bible thumpers and people who didn't understand the way that the world works and who were medieval. Mm-hmm. And this is the reaction to the flood as well. Like H.L. Mencken, who is a pretty caustic writer and very much a critic of the South. He's somebody who covered that Scopes trial and wrote some pretty harsh things. He basically made the argument that the flood was just evidence of how things in the U.S. always worked. The South gets in trouble and the North has to come and bail it out because the South doesn't know how to take care of itself. And that sentiment was very strong. And you see it again and again with disasters in the South. You could argue that you saw it with Katrina as people were like, you know, should we rebuild New Orleans or just let it all sink
underwater? Wright Thompson's blood pressure is rising like the banks of the Mississippi as you're describing this.
There's like a biblical element to this too, which is very Old Testament, which is very like the plagues of the boll weevil, the flooding of the Red Sea, like all of these sort of like biblical relics come to fore as sort of a God is judging the South for its sins kind of thing. And I think North will always carry the sort of like moral authority when and it's not just limited to North. I think particularly the Northeast has this kind of like moral authority about like how it sees the rest of the country that is just, it's not fair and it's not right. But we see these narratives play out time and time again.
And I mean, there's something too. I mean, Mencken's not totally wrong. You know, I mean, that's the, this area was functioning as a colony in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were people getting wealthy and, you know, some of them were local and, you know, most of them were international bankers. There is something to that, that this was an insane chase for profit. And those people who drown were just one of the many, many, many souls chewed up so that some distant person could get their 12% instead of their 8%. You know, they were putting sandbags up because somebody wanted their 12%.
Yeah.
But when you hear language like, well, maybe no one should live there, maybe we should abandon it, or you heard earnest conversation in the wake of Katrina saying, well, maybe New Orleans shouldn't exist anymore, you know. How does that fit into the puzzle?
I mean, fuck you, first of all.
Not me, I'm quoting.
No, I know.
People are talking.
But like, you know, I mean, is it Tennessee Williams? There are only two American cities, San Francisco and New Orleans and everywhere else.
And the rest is Cleveland? Is that the quote?
Yeah. Like
that?
So, yeah. I mean, you know.
Ouch.
You know, we shouldn't have Cleveland for, you know, I mean, the anybody who says that's never had 48 hours in New Orleans with me, that is first of all. But what is interesting, and this is James Carville, who's a good friend of mine, says that he thinks the role of government is to dull the sharp edges of capitalism. Because it chews people up almost by design. And that the role of government should be to try to lessen that as much as possible. And so you had all of these people pulled to work in New Orleans because it was a port, or pulled to work in the Mississippi Delta, who went to work in Detroit in factories. And so, you know, the state and all of us benefit from that. And so one of the roles of government is to dull the sharp edges of capitalism. And there will always be people living in every place where our economy once needed people. And when the economy moves on, the people remain. And I just have a hard time saying, you know, they should just move.
And, you know, on that note, this story is as much about the people who should have known better and should have cared more abandoning the people they should have been looking after as much as it is about man versus nature or anything else.
Absolutely.
It's 100%. I mean, this isn't man versus nature. This is man versus man.
All right. Well, look, we could do this for a long, long time, right? It's a pleasure, as always.
I'm so sorry. I talked way too much. The other people should say stuff.
You're on here to talk, right?
I'm very clear. I'm so sorry. You just called me on something I actually, like, love to talk about.
Well, that's why we got you.
That's why we got you. Yeah, no, this is great.
That's the whole point.
People listen to us all the time.
I'm so sorry.
No.
We invited you into the cockpit.
I know.
Exactly. Wright Thompson, thank you. As always, you can read his work at ESPN and The Atlantic. And I will say the book Pappy Land is out there. Wonderful history of the most coveted bourbon in the world. So go check that out. As in addition to watching True South, which is a wonderful binge material if you ever want to go and watch that. But anyway, Wright, thank you so much for everything you do and for joining us, as always.
This was great. Thanks.
And Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
River rolls all day, the river rolls all night. Some people got lost in the flood. Some people got away all right. River has busted through, clear down the Plaquemine. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline, Louisiana, Louisiana. They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away.
Radiotopia.